This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, the 23rd of January, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. President Bush prepares for a lengthy State of the Union, and Democrats gear up their response. We'll take a look at the Republican split on Capitol Hill over how to proceed in Iraq. And Palestinians take precautions against increased kidnappings.
A guy with a Kalashnikov came and pointed the gun at us. I pushed the Kalashnikov away. I rose from where I was sitting, and then I pulled the mask off one of the guys.
We'll bring you those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Israel's attorney general has stated that enough evidence exists to indict President Moshe Katsav on charges of rape and other crimes involving abuse of power. Three women have accused Katsav of indecent acts during his term as president. Another female staffer has accused him of rape and of indecent acts accompanied by the use of force when he was Minister of Tourism. The Israeli president will be able to give his version of events in a hearing with the country's attorney general before he can be formally charged with a crime. Katsav's attorneys have already indicated that the president will resign if indicted. In Israel, the presidency is a largely ceremonial position. In other news from the Middle East, the U.S. has sent a second group of aircraft carriers to the Persian Gulf as part of an increasingly confrontational standoff stemming from Iran's refusal to stop its uranium enrichment program. Not since the 2003 invasion of Iraq has the U.S. had two aircraft carrier groups in the Persian Gulf region at one time. Meanwhile, Iranian armed forces began 5 days of war games yesterday in the central part of the country. Today, the FARS news agency reported that the Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps successfully test-fired two short-range missiles. A suicide bomber reportedly killed 10 people today when he blew himself up outside of a NATO military base in eastern Afghanistan. The bomber detonated his explosives while in a crowd of workers waiting to enter the base. It was the deadliest suicide attack in Afghanistan in nearly 4 months. An American and a Briton have been kidnapped in Nigeria's Niger Delta region. This comes as the government of the Philippines banned its citizens from working in Nigeria. Sam Alakoya reports from Lagos.
Gunmen kidnapped the American and Briton while on their way to work. Both men work for a construction company in the Niger Delta region. The incident comes only 3 days after 24 Filipino seamen were also kidnapped in the region. The government of the Philippines reacted to the incident by barring Filipino citizens from traveling to Nigeria for work. The government says the ban will remain in force until the security of its citizens is guaranteed. Most of the 4,000 Filipinos in Nigeria work in the country's oil industry. Local groups fighting for a share of oil revenue have kidnapped scores of foreign oil workers in recent months. In the Niger Delta region, where Nigeria's oil comes from, local communities still remain desperately poor despite more than 40 years of oil exploitation. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
The World Court in The Hague has rejected a request from Uruguay to order Argentina to break blockades on bridges along the river which forms their common border. Asli Pellet reports from Montevideo.
The roadblocks have been a reaction to the dispute over Uruguay's plan to build two pulp mills on its side of the river, which Argentina says will damage the environment and harm tourism. The Uruguayan government claimed that last year the blockades had already costed more than $200 million in lost trade and tourism. The UN back today ruled 14-1 against Uruguay's argument that the blockades cause irreparable harm. This is the second time the court has declined to issue an interim injunction in the case. Last July, it rejected Argentina's request to order the immediate halt of construction of the mills until a final ruling on whether their operation would violate international agreements. The Finnish consortium Botnia is building one mill near Fray Bentos, a town of some 23,000 people, across the river from Gualeguaychú, an Argentine tourist resort with 80,000 residents. Spain's ENCE Corporation halted construction of their mill in August and recently announced they plan on setting up a site elsewhere in Uruguay. Asta Perit for Free Speech Radio News in Montevideo, Uruguay.
And finally, tens of thousands of mourners participated in a funeral march in Istanbul today for murdered Turkish-Armenian newspaper editor Hrant Dink. The journalist was particularly outspoken about World War I-era massacres of Armenians by Ottoman Turks, and because of this had faced prosecution under a law that makes it a crime to insult Turkishness. Dink was gunned down on Friday outside of his newspaper's office. A 17-year-old Turkish nationalist has since confessed to the murder. And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
In news from Iraq, the U.S. military says that 600 Mehdi Army fighters have been captured, including 16 militia leaders. The Shia fighters, loyal to cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, have been captured in more than 50 operations over the past 45 days. The Mehdi Army is reported to have as many as 600,000 fighters. Meanwhile, on Capitol Hill, there's a split in the Republican Party on how to proceed in Iraq. Republican representatives in both the House and the Senate expressed deep concerns over President Bush's plans for Iraq, particularly troop escalation. That concern was obvious today at the Senate Armed Services Committee hearing, as Lieutenant General David Petraeus testified to be the new Iraq commander. Nan McCurdy has more from Capitol Hill.
Texas Congressman Sam Johnson is one of many Republicans who support the Bush administration in sending more than 20,000 additional troops to Iraq.
Our guys over there deserve the full support of this Congress. They're fighting for America. And I fear for all this talk of Washington about pulling funding for our troops.
It's not clear how many Republican lawmakers support Bush's escalation of the war, but concern is growing. Dozens of Republican congresspeople are distancing themselves from Bush's plan, and yesterday a group of GOP lawmakers called for a bipartisan oversight committee on Iraq. Republican House Leader John Boehner says he wants a congressional check on the White House's management of the war.
In there, we also make clear that there are benchmarks that need to be met if we're going to succeed, the president's plan is going to succeed, on bringing a safer and more secure Iraq, and frankly, a safer and more secure United States.
Republican senators are also distancing themselves from President Bush. Senator John Warner of Virginia was one of three Republicans to propose a resolution yesterday that states that the Senate disagrees with the president's plan to increase forces by 21,500 and urges the president to consider all options and all alternatives with reduced force levels.
I just say respectfully to the president, we urge him to consider other options to use a lesser number of troops. Particularly, we've had in briefings of recent, the growing sentiment among the Iraqi people, the rank and file, that they don't want more foreign troops on their soil. They're anxious, some of them express, leave now. But I think leaving precipitously could topple that situation into an all-out civil war and imploding, which has disastrous consequences, as we all know.
The Republican resolution is expected to get a lot of support from Republican senators who want to go on record against a troop escalation, but who don't want to vote for the rival resolution that includes much greater criticism of the president's plan. That resolution is sponsored by Democratic Senator Joseph Biden of Delaware and Republican Chuck Hagel of Nebraska. Last night, discussions had already begun between the authors of the different resolutions, and it's likely that a negotiated resolution against troop escalation will be approved Wednesday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Republican Senator Susan Collins of Maine was a co-author, along with Senator Warner and Senator Coleman, of the Republican resolution against troop buildup. At the Senate hearing for General Petraeus, Senator Collins said that when she was in Iraq a month ago, Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki told her he did not welcome additional troops. Senator Collins also quoted from General Petraeus' written testimony that reads, "A liberating force must act quickly because every army of liberation has a half-life beyond which it turns into an army of occupation."
This insight seems right on the money to me. You talk about this being a race against the clock, but I wonder if the clock has already run out. if we're already perceived by the vast majority of Iraqis not as liberators anymore, but as occupiers.
General Petraeus.
And that in some areas, interestingly, areas where we came to be seen as armies, an army of occupation, we might now once again be seen as an army of liberation because we help provide the degree of security that has been lacking in their lives.
It's likely General Petraeus will be confirmed as the top U.S. commander for Iraq. Despite congressional concern, President Bush says he'll continue to send more troops to Iraq. 3,000 troops have already been sent. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nan McCurdy.
The president will give his seventh State of the Union address tonight. It's his first one before a Democratic Congress and the first time a woman Speaker of the House will preside. In addition to facing a Democratic chamber, the president will have additional challenges. His approval ratings are the lowest they've been for a State of the Union, and opposition to his biggest priority, the war in Iraq, is at an all-time high. But the president will not be short on words. His speech, expected to run about 50 minutes long, will focus on domestic issues, but it will not neglect the war in Iraq. Washington editor Leanne Caldwell previews the State of the Union address and the Democratic response.
In last year's State of the Union, the president spent 25 minutes of his 50-minute speech on Iraq and terrorism. He was trying to convince an American audience of the necessity of the war, at a time the popular sentiment was turning from unyielding support to skepticism. Regardless, the president still sent a message of optimism.
I am confident in our plan for victory. I am confident in the will of the Iraqi people. I am confident in the skill and spirit of our military fellow citizens. We are in this fight to win, and we are winning.
This year, he is facing an audience in which the majority of citizens and a majority of Congress disapprove of his handling of the war and oppose his recent decision to add more than 21,000 troops to the conflict. Tonight's State of the Union is expected to devote less time on Iraq specifically. In an effort to assure Americans that his strategy is the right one, the president is expected to talk about the war in Iraq as part of the broader war on terror, a war that will keep Americans safe, he will say. Meanwhile, Democrats have prepared their response. Assistant Senate Democratic Leader Richard Durbin will host a blog after the president's speech. And newly elected Senator James Webb of Virginia will deliver their official reaction. His son is in the military, and he ousted a Republican incumbent in November with a campaign that focused on ending the war. Regardless of what the president says, Democrats plan to focus their reaction on Iraq. They'll push for a reduction of the emphasis on the military, with more effort put toward diplomacy. Representative Rahm Emanuel, member of the Democratic leadership, laid out the differences between the Democratic strategy and the president's, referencing the suggestions of the Iraq Study Group, led by Commissioners James Baker and Lee Hamilton.
One of the things I think is unfortunate is that the Iraq Study Group was about 90% diplomatic. The president's solution is about 90% military. Democrats believe firmly that the Iraq Study Group should have gotten more of a hearing and believe that it has the right kind of mix of both political and diplomatic initiatives to bring the civil strife and Americans' involvement in that civil strife to a better conclusion.
The president is expected to devote most of his time to his domestic agenda, health, education, energy, and immigration. He will present a plan to cover the uninsured, which would provide tax breaks for some and an increase in taxes for others. He will urge Congress to reauthorize No Child Left Behind, and he'll push for an increase in corn-based ethanol to cut dependence on oil. In their response, Democrats say expanded health coverage is essential, and they support No Child Left Behind if it's fully funded. And they'll support energy initiatives that combat global warming. But Democratic Representative Rahm Emanuel says that doesn't mean they'll agree with the president's plans.
We're going to be open to the president's proposals. We probably share the goals. The road you got to get there, we may have some disagreements, and we're going to go work on that.
The president is also expected to talk about immigration reform, something the Democrats supported last year but have not made a priority this year. The president's speech will begin at 9 p.m. Eastern this evening. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And Pacifica and Free Speech Radio News are covering the president's speech live this evening with instant reaction from Capitol Hill, activists, and analysts. Our coverage begins at 8:30 p.m. Eastern on many of these stations. The Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade has released a French diplomat and two aides captured in the West Bank city of Nablus today. The three worked at the French consulate in Jerusalem and were taken on suspicion of being Israeli undercover agents, but released hours later. Today's kidnappings underscore the lack of security in the occupied territories, a situation that's persisted amidst fighting between the rival Hamas and Fatah parties. That fighting has brought gunmen out into the streets of Gaza and caused street clashes and kidnappings. Iris Mackler has more.
Riyad Alua watches while his wife Khatima picks lemons from the trees he planted in their garden in the village of Tira in northern Israel. He can't believe that he's back home after being held for 47 days as a hostage in Gaza.
I consider myself to be a very strong man. I'm not one of those that becomes afraid easily. But when it comes to kidnapping, no one is strong.
The 46-year-old truck driver is too badly hurt to help his wife pick fruit. He has spinal injuries, a broken cheekbone, broken fingers, and no front teeth as a result of beatings he received from his kidnappers.
My fingers, my nails, my hand, my head, all of this happened when they first got me. I never thought I would come out of this in one piece.
Riyad Aluha was born in Gaza. In his 20s, he married an Arab woman who's an Israeli citizen. They moved to her family village of Tira in northern Israel, but kept up their contact with Gaza, visiting each year. Last October, Alua and his wife and six children went to Gaza to celebrate a Muslim holiday. When they were driving to the border to go home, masked gunmen surrounded the car. His wife Khatima describes what happened next.
A guy with a Kalashnikov came and pointed the gun at us. I pushed the Kalashnikov away. I rose from where I was sitting, and then I pulled the mask off one of the guys.
Khatima's courage resulted in her being shot in both legs. The Palestinian gunman left her bleeding and unconscious by the side of the road and abducted her husband. They bound and gagged him, then accused him of being a collaborator with the Israeli army. Aluha denied this vehemently, but the gunman began torturing and interrogating him to force him to confess.
I was chained in the chest. A sack was all over my head. My hands were chained behind me, and they were beating me with a hose.
The kidnappers weren't interested in money. They never asked for a ransom or contacted Aluha's family. After his wife Khatima was released from hospital, she returned home with her traumatized children. She prepared their meals, limping and crying constantly, but says she never gave up hope that her husband would come home. In the end, her prayers were answered, because Riyad Aluha refused to confess to anything he hadn't done. After nearly 7 weeks, the gunman released him. Aluha says he still has no idea who they were.
The people that kidnapped me are the same people that are roaming the streets of Gaza, masked and shooting at everybody. Are they Hamas? Are they Fatah? Are they other factions? Nobody will ever find out. You should see how Gaza is now. It's like a jungle. It's like Vietnam. Everybody carrying a Kalashnikov and thinking that he has the power to do whatever he or she wants. A situation like this cannot continue.
The Aluha family concedes that they were lucky they could get out of Gaza. Most Palestinians are not allowed to leave the narrow strip and are forced to cope with the mounting chaos as best they can. Iris Mackler, Free Speech Radio News, Tira, Northern Israel.
Israel has released some of the money it's been withholding from the Palestinian Authority since a Hamas-led government was installed in January of last year. The released money would be allocated for humanitarian relief. FSRN's Rami Al-Makhari has more.
Israel released a total of $100 million, about one-fifth of the customs duties, which it is supposed to hand over to the Palestinian Authority. The decision came amidst a growing rivalry between the two largest Palestinian parties, Hamas and Fatah, that has so far claimed lives of at least 330 Palestinians, including children and women. Some analysts believe that the released fund meant to bolster the position of Palestinian President and Fatah chief Mahmoud Abbas. After Hamas came to power in elections last January, Israel and the international community imposed an economic embargo, saying they won't do business with Palestine unless Hamas renounces violence, recognizes Israel's right to exist, and accepts past signed peace agreements. Ghazi Hamad, spokesman of the Hamas-led government.
First, these funds are Palestinian, coming out of accumulated custom and tax money due to the Palestinian side by the Israeli side. We cannot deny that the president had a role in getting this money back, and the government had a similar role also in bringing about funds, so we have no choice but to coordinate channeling such funds.
Fatah believes Israel's release of the money will help alleviate some of the Palestinians suffering under the harsh economic conditions, which have gotten worse since the Hamas-led government took power. Mohammed Al-Hurani, a senior Fatah member.
It will never help President Mahmoud Abbas, as the presidency has received through many donors funds that have been allocated for health and education, and this money will be allocated for humanitarian projects. No doubt that the Palestinian residents realize the fact that the last year was a year of isolation and failure. Has this affected Hamas? I think it has.
The 3.5 million Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza Strip gave a mixed reaction to the move. Bakir Bashir, a teacher from Gaza.
For 10 months, the embargo has been repressive. As for the released money, we have heard that it would not be allocated for the salaries. And this would definitely add to the bad situation. If we resort to strike, that would mean our situation would be so miserable by then.
Since March 2006, 160,000 Palestinians have seen their salaries cut. Commercial and travel crossings have been frequently closed. Basic services have been cut, and poverty rates have climbed 70%, according to Palestinian sources. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari reporting from Gaza.
Over 3 million men, women, and children were homeless in the United States during the past year, according to the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty. Those numbers are increasing as affordable housing and jobs paying a living wage decline. Violent crimes against the homeless are prevalent, and recent events surrounding a tent city in St. Petersburg, Florida, provide a reminder of the difficulties and dangers faced by the homeless. Sean Kanan reports.
Near the end of December, residents and businesses in St. Petersburg put pressure on a group of homeless people camping out on public land across the street from the St. Vincent de Paul Society building. That society offered to let the homeless set up tents on their privately owned land, and about 160 people formed what came to be called Tent City. But less than a week after its formation, the city warned residents that it would soon be shut down for code violations. After a few delays, residents were evicted from Tent City on Saturday, January 13th. The community fragmented and two new tent sites sprung up, but last Friday, without warning, the police and fire departments of the city dramatically descended on the new tent city and destroyed and removed all of the tents, some of which were being occupied by people who work at night and sleep during the day. Wanda Langdon is a resident of Tent City. She had just finished setting up her tent at the new site when the St. Petersburg police and fire departments arrived.
I was highly upset. All of a sudden, there's 15 cruisers in the driveway. Fire trucks on both sides blocking the entrances, and there's four car cops in each car. And they come out with box cutters and knives and scissors and just go to town on their tents. Didn't give us any warning at all. Didn't give me any warning. I talked to an officer like an hour before that, and she didn't say nothing about it. And I saw her there, and she had tears coming down her face because she knew that she was hurting me.
Homeless advocate Reverend Bruce Wright runs the Refuge Ministry and was involved in negotiations with the city. He feels that city officials broke their agreement with the residents of the new tent city.
As a show of good faith, the officers in charge and the fire marshal in charge agreed, okay, we're not going to take any action until we consult you. Well, later that afternoon, without consulting us, the homeless tent cities were attacked. And we know it's the mayor because the mayor is defending it.
Last Wednesday, a few days after the city shut down the original tent city, two of the men who had been evicted were found murdered not far away. The victims, Jeff Schultz and David Heath, were remembered at a vigil and memorial service Monday night. Kenneth Schweinberg is a former resident of Tent City. At the memorial service, he recalled worrying with Schultz about what they would do after they were evicted by the city.
The only time I had seen him was that Friday, and you know, he was worried about where he was going with the homeless people and stuff like that. I mean, he was worried just like I was, you know, where he didn't know where he was going the next day. I mean, he worked every night. He slept in my tent, one of my tents. He slept at night, I mean, during the daytime and worked during the night. I mean, for what had happened, if they would have kept Tent City open at the time, you know, this probably would have never happened.
Tent City resident Tina May blames the death of the two men on the closing of the original homeless camp by the city, with the complicity of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in their refusal to fight the city's eviction order.
The simple fact is, since they closed that place down, they put two lives in jeopardy. Know what I'm saying? If they had never closed that place down, they'd have been alive today. I'm sorry to say that, but it's true.
Many residents of Tent City speak of their solidarity and how they shared tents with those who didn't have a place to sleep. There was also security in being together in a community, according to Reverend Wright.
It offered protection, it offered security, it offered all kinds of things. Well, at that point, the homeless were very fearful of being booted out of Tent City, and even the fear had been heightened because of the murders. And their only sense of security was taken away. And then, when the attack happened, pandemonium ensued. People were frightened, angry, worried. We were able to get some semblance of order again.
Homeless advocates are considering a lawsuit against the city of St. Petersburg to compensate for possessions destroyed in the raid. There are not yet any suspects in the murder of the two men. A smaller tent city remains near the site of the original one, but the homeless and their advocates continue working to find permanent housing solutions. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sean Canaan, reporting from St. Petersburg, Florida.
Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. Today's newscast was produced by Tay Nagisi and Aaron Glantz. He's sitting in for Monica Lopez. Our Washington editor is Leanne Caldwell. Headlines editor is Shannon Young. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Antonio Ortiz and Eric Klein. You can listen to this newscast in its entirety online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. We welcome your questions, comments, and story ideas. Just email us at comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.